Hello, it's Owen Shehan here from Off The Ball, and the FIFA World Cup 2026 is here. And let's be honest, the matchday version of ourselves can look a little committed. Jerseys, face paint, scarves and questionable weather, whatever you have, maybe even a full costume if your team makes a run, you can look a little worse for wear come the end of it all. But the World Cup, it's not just about the football. It's the atmosphere, it's the nights in the pub, it is the watch parties with your mates, and maybe even meeting someone new. That is where Lynx comes in. As an official personal care sponsor of the FIFA World Cup 2026, Lynx's premium fragrances are here to help you smell your best, even in the middle of full matchday madness. Lynx, smell your best when you look your worst. Now, enjoy your podcast.
Off The Ball Breakfast, Ireland's sports breakfast show.
Mbappe, and look, I've been a long sceptic of Mbappe. I thought, you know, because he had it too easy.
Live every weekday morning from 7:30 on your smart speaker. Just ask Alexa to play OTB Sports Radio.
Off The Ball Breakfast.
With Optimum Nutrition, there's more of you in you. Unlock it with the world's number one sports nutrition brand.
All right, we have a very, very special episode of You Had To Be There because we are joined in studio by the one and only Danny Dyer.
Thank you so much. What a wonderful introduction.
Good morning. You were telling us there you're a massive fan of the show and you tune in every morning.
I love the show and I'm obsessed with the Perrier. And, you know, what a threesome that would be, us three, eh? Three men just going at it.
It's lucky we just turned on the camera just there.
Yeah. I mean, look at that.
Look at you. And you're dead centre as well.
Pure sex.
Just the way you insisted as well to go dead centre of the shot.
I'd like to be in the middle. I'm used to.
This is my description of the movie Marching Powder. Okay, you ready?
Give it to me.
An outrageous comedy filled with addiction, hooliganism, violence, and happy endings. Succinct?
I love that.
Accurate?
You've nailed it.
For people who haven't seen the movie, it's only coming out. Describe it to us. I was like, I watched The Football Factory at the time, 2004. We're 20 years on.
Yeah,
for me,
mate.
It felt like you age with those characters. This is like the middle-aged version of The Football Factory, but it doesn't take itself as seriously. But
no.
By God, the repetition of the chaos is insane.
Well, I suppose, listen, look, obviously we've got our fans, me and Nick, and we made some amazing films back in the day. Now, we've not worked together. This is our fifth collab. Our fifth film. But we've not. But the break between the last film and this one's been 15 years. We both went our separate ways for a little while. He's a very important man to me. I love him very much. He's a very important filmmaker. I was a bit off the rails. I lost the plot slightly and I ended up in Walford, Albert Square.
Right.
Which, again, I'm very proud of.
Yeah.
But he was off doing his thing. I was doing my thing. Anyway, I've left Albert Square and the first person I wanted to work with was with Nick. And he came and he had this idea. And it's about... you know, where does a white working class middle-aged man sit in society now? It's an important question.
Yeah.
His optics are all wrong. And if he's still running around headbutting people at football and he's still taking cocaine and, you know, just being a general twat, you know, where does he sit in society? It's like, it's about addiction. It is about a man that just can't shake his, you know, this sort of, he's stuck within this sort of rut, right? He is still into hooliganism.
Yeah.
But it's ridiculous. And what we're doing is we're doing it in a very light-hearted way. Like you said, it's not too heavy. We're having a nod to the old films. But, you know, the big first tear-up, it's got commentary over it.
Yes.
So it sets the tone.
Like a football match.
It sets the tone, like a football match.
So like the
you've got pundits talking about 40 geezers in Stone Island and CP Company headbutting each other and how ridiculous it is. So, you know, it's about a man who's got 6 weeks to sort his life out. Can he do it? And it's about a man and a woman trying to save their relationship as well. So what we've done is we've grown up a little bit. Nick's grown up a little bit. We're trying to make a different kind of film, and this is it. It's a rom-com. It is. It's which people are going to be surprised at.
Like, God bless your wife in the film. There's something about your character that she just can't run away from. Because, like Danny, I was lucky enough to watch this on the big screen. I got an advanced screening of it, and there was a good few of us there. And, like, at times you want to look away because you're like, will he ever sort himself out, this character, Jack? I counted about four times where I thought, all right, he's going to do it now. This is the road to redemption. But there's something about the character that you still root for him, but you're furious with him.
Absolutely. And that's what we're trying to do is that, you know, what is love? Love is that you fall in love with people's flaws. You do. It's their quirky sort of weirdness. You don't, you know, you, 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 you sort of love him for it and you hate him for it as well. Do you know what I mean? Some of them flaws you do become quite irritated with. You know, there's some relationships you can be in where actually when you're breathing, your wife hates you for it. You know what I mean?
Tell us who you're talking about there.
But it's important to highlight, you know, that with addiction, you know, people that are trying to do the right thing with addiction, you don't necessarily start taking drugs again or pick up drugs again when it's all shit and bad, right? It's when life becomes all quite normal and safe and lovely, is when you're more likely to start doing stupid things again. There's a segment when I'm babysitting my son
first
time.
Oh my God, I was just
going to
say.
Well, he's 11, right? So, yeah. And there'll be a lot of men out there that are guilty of this. You know, they haven't really put the time and effort into their kids. And you know, it's important that, you know, that we understand that being a patriarch, being a shit dad will affect your kids. Even if you're not around them, they will watch your behaviours. And we're trying to, and it comes across in this film, because obviously JJ, played by my real son, RT.
Oh, well.
Isn't it? You know, he's starting to pick up his dad's traits. So anyway, there's a whole segment where I babysit him for the first time and we improvise the whole thing. It's a really mad segment. It's quite touching, I think. And I think it will touch a lot of men out there because, you know, there's a moment where I sort of cuddle him and at the end I tell him I love him probably for the first time. And then I try and put a wash on with a washing machine. Yeah. And most men have no idea. And again, I'm not just stereotyping. Let's have it right. Yeah. And it's when he tries to put his... And he's trying to do the right thing. It's all going well for him. His missus is out. He's babysitting. He's now going to put a wash on. He's going to the next level. And when he picks the jeans up, he finds a wrap of cocaine.
Yeah.
A pink wrap. And it's then where he goes, it'll be fine. I'm doing everything right. I've earned this. And that's when we start the whole spiral again.
There's like a kind of hint at the supernatural at times, you know, when you're in the cubicle. And there's a voice talking to you.
Yeah.
And I was going to mention this babysitting. I had no idea that was your real son. That's amazing.
Well, boy, yes, mate, isn't it?
Do you know what it reminded me of? That segment is like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, the Johnny Depp movie. It's like, it's wild.
Yeah.
And you're like, you keep pushing it and pushing it, where most movies at that point, there's a point in that scene where I'm like, okay, they're going to hold back now.
Yeah.
And you're just like, no, let's test it one more time.
No, that's right.
And there wasn't many more steps you could have gone in that scene.
No, absolutely. And, you know, this is what I'm saying about our films, is that they've got some bollocks. You know, we want to push the boundaries. And, you know, there's trigger warnings for fucking shit now. We're adults. Let us make our own decisions on trigger warnings. You know, if you're going to come and watch a Danny Dyer, Nick Love film, there's probably going to have the word cunt in it. I do apologise. But that's probably going to be the case. And there is a lot of swearing in this, not just from the men, but the women as well. I was brought up by very strong women, you know, and they swore a lot.
Yeah.
Very strong women from the East End of London. Not in an aggressive way, in almost in a term of endearment. It's the truth.
That's what you said before we started recording. It's the way you word the cursing.
It's about
intent,
really. It
makes it poetic and beautiful.
It's about intent, for sure. So, you know, so it's authentic, our film. And I will say that all the boys in it, other than the main five actors, which is obviously me, Bailey, Dean, and Joe, like the main little firm, the rest of the firm are real football people, we'll say.
Also, I'd say this is going to appeal to like a wide demographic and genders as well, because a lot of times in these movies, it's the long-suffering wife, and we don't know anything. We don't know anything about the wife. But your wife in the movie has her own storyline.
Yeah,
has her own thing going on.
And she has an incredible speech. It was important to Nick to start trying to write for a woman. He's never done that before. Yeah. And especially a strong woman, not a victim. You know, someone that actually, and her speech to me at the end, when she actually just lays it all on the line, is brilliant. It's
in the restaurant.
It's really, really powerful stuff. And, you know, and she alludes to the fact that, you know, that there's, you know, because I think men, obviously, and especially masculine men, think they rule the house and everything. They don't, actually. The man that says he's the governor in his house is a fucking liar. You know, there's no good strong men without a strong woman by their side. I really do believe that. And women, not all women are victims, you know, and especially in this, you know, so she really does hold her own. And I think that's down to Stephanie Leonidis as well, who's incredible in this film.
I'll say that one of the other real reasons to watch this is you genuinely can't predict how it's going to end. And I don't want to give anything away there. But there is a moment where it's like the closest thing I've seen to Renton's famous monologue in Trainspotting is replicated by you at some point. It's a different sentiment, but same idea.
It's a great monologue at the end, and it's something that we shot it sort of semi in order, so I was at my most fucked when we had to do that as well, most tired. Yeah. I mean, we worked it out. We shot it over 5 weeks, and within each week, there was a big major tear-up. There was a big fight. So we only gave one day for the fight. So you get up in the morning, you have a bacon roll, and then from 8 o'clock in the morning till 7 o'clock at night, there's 60 geezers just going at it. And, you know, I'm pushing 50. So yeah. I was blowing out my arse for a lot of it, you know what I mean? So, you know, by the end of this job, I was absolutely exhausted. You know, it took a lot out of me because I'm in 98% of it.
Hello, it's Owen Chahan here from Off The Ball, and the FIFA World Cup 2026 is here. And let's be honest, the matchday version of ourselves can look a little committed. Jerseys, face paint, scarves and questionable weather, whatever you have, maybe even a full costume if your team makes a run, you can look a little worse for wear come the end of it all. But the World Cup, it's not just about the football. It's the atmosphere, it's the nights in the pub, it is the watch parties with your mates, and maybe even meeting someone new. That is where Lynx comes in. As an official personal care sponsor of the FIFA World Cup 2026, Lynx's premium fragrances are here to help you smell your best, even in the middle of full matchday madness. Lynx, smell your best when you look your worst. Now, enjoy your podcast.
You know, and it's there's only a couple of scenes away from me, and I had to draw on all my experience to get through it, I must say.
You're not method acting, are you?
Who, mate?
Yeah, that's like
no,
your approach.
I'm too old for all that. I don't get all that method acting. I ain't got the time, mate. Fuck all that.
Yeah, just act.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, you get your script, you learn it, and you try and bring it to life. That's it. And then go home and try and be normal. You know, method. I don't understand, like, living and breathing it. It's too exhausting for me.
I don't want to misquote you here, so correct me if I'm wrong, but in research, you said one time, I've done over 40 films, and I'd say maybe 9 of them are good. But this is obviously number 10, or maybe more
well,
now
I think
at this stage.
I think I've done maybe 45 films, and I'm thinking about it, racking my brains. Yeah, maybe 10 at a push. Look, I'm talking about cult sort of classics.
Human Traffic.
Human Traffic being the first film I ever made, which I understand now. We made that in 1997. Came out in 99. But I understand now that my Human Traffic fans are a thing. They're my hippie fans. They're calm. They're cool. They've got a lot of love in their heart. You know, and as you sort of get later on into the Football Factory fans, anyone with a Burberry cap and a scar down their face, and you know, the most aggressive geezer in the pub is going to know who I am. You know, the people that the geezer that everyone avoids is going to be my best mate. So my fans have changed over the years, but I do think I've been around long enough to go that there's a generation of youngsters that grew up on my films. And that makes me feel, you know, makes me feel good inside for some
and
reason.
Now a bunch of middle-aged women are throwing their knickers at you because they're rivals.
Very odd. Yeah, this is a whole new realm for
Explain
me.
Explain that one.
I don't know. I had a moustache and I had a dodgy wig, and yet I've become a sex symbol. So, and especially for sort of middle upper class women as well, who'd have thought that maybe they like a bit of rough. Look, I'm just riding the wave of it. We're about to shoot the second series. It's very exciting to me. I'm glad that old Fred's getting the love.
How did that come about? Did you chase that? Was that the type
no,
of thing?
No, I'll tell you what happened with that. Is that Dominic Treadwell Collins, who produced it, actually brought me into EastEnders. So when I was at my lowest ebb and on my arse and I couldn't catch a cold because I'd made many, many shit films, I was just going to nightclubs and waving off of balconies, you know, off my head, you know, because I had to pay the mortgage and I had bailiffs at the door. Anyway, Dominic Treadwell Collins comes into my life and goes, listen, I think you're brilliant. I want you to come in and I want you to take over the Queen Vic with a new family. I was like, fucking hell. Because I was skint. And I mean, I tried to play it cool, actually, and go, well, you know, I'm a film star, even though I didn't have a fucking pot to piss in. And I was like, okay. And he went, listen, you know, you're going to be an alpha male who wears a pink dressing gown. I thought, well, that's different. So he sees something different in me. I'm not going to come in with a shotgun chasing Phil Mitchell around. I'm actually a geezer who's got something about him, but very sensitive, loves his family, and wears a pink dressing gown. So, you know, he brought me into the show. We turned the show around. The show was on its ass. We had an amazing 4 years, you know, of the whole Carter family. Then he left, and then it sort of got a bit weird for me. Anyway, I then left EastEnders, and then he rings me again. He goes, listen, Dan, I've got this project. It's called Rivals. There's a part in it. You're not the lead, but I'd love you to be in it. And I was like, well, I don't think I can do it because I was doing something else at the time. There's something that was about to start, and that was a show called Mr. Big Stuff, which I did. Anyway, he went away to try and find this character, Freddie, but wanted me to do it, couldn't find him, then came back and said, Danny, it's Disney. Why are you saying no? And I was like, fuck me, it is Disney. Like, and I hadn't read any of them. I said, just sum the character up for me because I love him and I trust him. And he said, like, he's a teddy bear with a bite. I went, I'm in. Because by this time, the other job I was going to do, it got pushed back.
Yeah.
So it just, for some reason, the stars aligned. And I hadn't even read them. I said yes. I went to the read through. I hadn't read any of them. I didn't know what the fuck was going to happen. And it was only when I started to film it, I started to read them and go, oh, this is fucking great.
Yeah.
But listen, when you work with Aidan Turner, Victoria Smurfit, you know, David Tennant, you know, you're working with fucking, like, these are the elite people for me. So I knew it was going to be cool and I knew it was going to be a great job. I certainly did not think it was going to pan out the way it has for me as an actor who's been around a long time. And all of a sudden, there was a headline, there was a review that said the biggest plot twist in Rivals is that Danny Dyer can act. And I thought, fucking cheers.
Yeah, cheers in a good way or cheers in a
way? Well, cheers in a way, fuck you way, yeah, actually. Yeah, to go, yeah, well, you know what? Yeah. I've been around long enough. I've done quite good stuff and some shit. But in general, I don't want your sort of like backhanded compliments. No, I don't want it. I'm fine. I'm feeding my kids. I'm earning a few quid. That's why I do it now. So yeah, for them to, the elite, to finally acknowledge me, it doesn't really matter to me.
But they weren't paying attention. Is the stuff about your relationship with Harold Pinter, that's all true?
Of course it is. He was my mentor. Well, he's like a father figure to me, you know.
Like that, you know.
But they didn't like it. They struggled with it, I think, and certain critics that... I always found this classism thing was a thing, like, in
it's
a sense...
It's a real thing, isn't it?
Well, it's a thing within theatre. And I think, you know, I can be a bit uncouth or a bit, you know... I'm certainly not articulate, I can talk in that, but I've got a very working-class accent, so...
That's articulate.
I realise there's a lot of isms in the world, and women go through a lot of it, and, you know, obviously racism is a thing. So what is racism? Racism is you get judged on the colour of your skin. So in round one, you're judged. Now, I get through round one because I'm white, but then I open my mouth, which is round two, and then I get judged. So classism hits me. It's the same with women's sexism. They're a woman, so they get, you know, they get their ism. There's a lot of it going on. It's very apparent to me within theatre. But when Harold took me under his wing, all these classy elite people started to suck round my ass somewhat because I was his mate. Mm. So, but they, in a way, they fucking hated it, but at the same time, they had to accept it. Yeah. And the fact is, Harold Pinter was from East London like me.
I was going to say, yeah.
He was. He's from Hackney, from Dalston.
So,
and I think he saw something in me, and he said to me, and I've said this in many interviews, he gave me the best advice I've ever had. He said, just be you, because everyone else is taken. And I thought, what does that mean? And now I get it.
Yeah, definitely.
It's important. So, you know, I miss him, man. He's been dead for a long time, but he was a very important part of my life.
Listen, we could do this for another hour on that topic particularly, but I know you have to go. I don't want to let you go without talking about your favourite sporting events.
Okay.
I can't imagine West Ham is far from... that, like, was it the last game in Upton Park, the heartbreaking FA Cup final, soccer aid, as you told me before?
Obviously West Ham being the one true love of my life, really, and it's been nothing but heartbreak until recently when some people call it the Mickey Mouse Cup. It's not. We won the Conference League and we lifted a trophy. Not many clubs that can say that. I didn't go to Prague. Now, the reason I didn't go to Prague is because I was playing in Soccer Aid the next day and I was training. So I'd never been asked to do Soccer Aid. And so Soccer Aid is you do 5 days training with professional players and, you know, people like Usain Bolt, Mo Farah. I mean, it's Tom Hiddleston. You know, you're sort of looking around.
Will Ferrell's a good player.
We had Joe Cole, Jack Wilshere. Roberto Carlos, Robbie Keane. Robbie Keane's a nightmare, by the way, because he plays for the rest of the world, of course. But he doesn't let people go to bed. Now, I thought it was a serious training session. But let me tell you something now. You know, there's a bar. And we do a bit of training, a bit of media, and of an evening. We like to enjoy ourselves and get on the karaoke and stuff like that. But Robbie Keane don't like people going to bed, especially if you play for the England team. And you say to him, look, Rob, I'm going to go to bed. He goes, what for? I go, well, you know, I'm playing football in front of 75,000 people. And he goes, what difference is it going to make you going to bed?
That's a good
line. Fair point. But what I say is, it's such an incredible cause, UNICEF that. But yet you get to pretend to be a footballer. So that's been amazing for me. I can't do it this year, unfortunately. I'm too busy. And also, there's a risk involved. But it's incredible. So I played at Old Trafford. We did Stamford Bridge last year. It's back in Old Trafford again.
Oh, yeah. Talk to us about West Ham now. I know Jared Bowen, we could do a whole category on that.
Where do
your
you start?
Future son-in-law?
They're getting married in a couple of months.
Ah, class. And talk to us about Evan Ferguson, because we're very keen for him to do well.
Well, I watched him last night. We beat Leicester at Awful. Get him down, Leicester. Get him down, they're a disgrace. I mean, for us, that were just walking pace, you know, and we've not been good this year. I do like Graham Potter. I love the idea of Evan. I think I remember when he first burst on the scene with Brighton, and everyone was raving about him. I think he's slightly injury prone, which we've had no luck with, but he looks like he's got something about him, this geezer. I would love to nick him from Brighton.
Right.
I'd love him to come to West Ham. Jared likes him a lot. He gets on with him.
Does he?
He thinks he's got, you know, something about him. So I really hope it works out for him at West Ham, because he will be a starter for us. You know, if he wants to. Oh yeah, he'll be a starter if he can stay fit. Because obviously, Falk Craig, it hasn't worked out with Antonio. Unfortunately, he's had an awful car crash, and I wish him all the best. I really hope this man does come back, but he's 33, 34. So we need a young Irish striker that's hungry and ambitious, and he could be a brilliant, brilliant signing for us. So I hope it works out for him at West Ham for the remainder of the season. So, you know.
What's the atmosphere like at the Olympic Stadium? Because I hear the London Stadium, there's a lot of criticism, and it's not quite like Upton Park.
No, nothing's going to be like Upton Park. I mean, it was on a council estate, and I think any like Everton have got it, and they're about to move. They'll see. Any ground in a council estate, it's just got something about
it. Yeah.
Now, I'm from the theory that the club chooses you. Now West Ham chose me because I lived a mile and a half away from the ground. And there was a park near me called King George Park, and it had a big hill. And if you stood on the top of the hill, you could see the floodlights in the distance and you could walk to the ground. But it was part of our area, it's part of our man. And we was always shite. But now and again, we'd nick 3 points off a big club and it felt the world. So once it went Upton Park, my dad still refuses to go to the London Stadium. Now, you know, it's massive. They said we wouldn't fill it. We fill it every week, 65,000 people, right? Because, you know, we're a proper race of people, the East Londoners. So sometimes it can feel a bit flat, for sure. I don't think the running track helps, but we've made some good memories there now. I've been there when there's been some stonking nights when we beat Lyon, Seville, big nights. And when everyone's singing Bubbles, mate, there's nothing quite like it. I've got to tell you, you know, it gives me a tingle, especially because my son-in-law is the captain of that club as
Pretty
well.
Pretty amazing, isn't
it? I can't tell you how it makes me feel. And every time I watch him and he scores a lot, I cry.
Don't say another word. That's the perfect way to end this interview. Marching Powder is out tomorrow, March 7th. What an episode of You Had to Be There. Danny, thank you.
Thank you. Absolute pleasure. Thank you.